Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the TakeCast. My name is Davis Maddock. You guys can find me on Twitter at Davis Maddock. In this episode of the show, I'm joined by my buddy John Bales to really talk a little bit of everything. You know, we talk some crypto, talk some markets, talk some long-term COVID ramifications, some moral philosophy, Bales's fake or maybe not fake Substack that he set up during the quarantine period. Of course, a little bit of push-up challenge, just a little bit of everything. I find Bales to be fascinating. I think he is one of my favorite people to talk to, and you know, really the entire DFS gambling internet sphere. I think that you guys will really enjoy the things that he has to say, and I hope that you guys enjoy the episode. If you want to support the show, you can subscribe on patreon.com/takecast for bonus episodes of the show, or you can just leave a rating or review on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. All of that is very useful and helpful, and now let's go ahead and get into the episode. All right, everyone, welcoming in my buddy, John Bales. No special occasion for John to be on the show this time. The last time we talked to him, he couldn't move. He had just completed the push-up challenge. He was very sore. And no special reason. I just hadn't talked to John in a while, and I thought that, I think that Mr. Bales is a fascinating guy. Bales, how often do people mention the push-up challenge to you on a daily basis in your life now in September?
It's still pretty often. I was just shocked at how many people tuned into that. It was like literally hundreds of thousands of people watched that. We didn't really plan for that to happen or set anything special up. So, it was a good time for, no sports going on, and people wanted to watch a meathead do push-ups in his office. So
do you feel from like a Fantasy Labs Action Network perspective that it was a missed opportunity to be churning some subscriptions and sell people some stuff? Like, do you feel like it was a failed business venture?
No, I don't know how many people are watching me do push-ups and then are like, oh man, I gotta bet on sports.
Man, I don't know. I think when people online are successful at anything, I think that really just primes people to buy stuff from you. I'm being dead ass serious. Like even watching you bang out those push-ups, and if you were like, if you want to learn the mental fortitude to beat DFS the way I just did those push-ups, subscribe at fantasylabs.com, promo code Bales. Like that, like I'm serious. I literally think that would have worked.
Well, we should have tried it, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah,
it might have been a missed opportunity. I was trying to make all that money from the push-ups, and I missed the subscription revenue, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and so the first thing I want to talk to you about actually lines up with that perfectly, because April, when that happened, that was really a time when, you know, a lot of people in our part of the world, so you know, daily fantasy and crypto and poker and everything, I would say the general investor probably did not start to buy lots of stocks and crypto and everything in April, but a lot of people in our part of the world did that. And you know, intelligent or not, lucky or not, a lot of those people have made a lot of money. And so I'm just very curious for your perspective, how much of, you know, just all of this, capital T this, stocks, crypto, sports cards, you know, whatever it is, your form of speculation, how much of this do you think is a bubble just really predicated on how much money the Federal Reserve has printed in 2020?
I don't know if I have great insights about how it relates to the Fed.
Sure. Yeah. Or just in general. Yeah.
All those things are separate to me. Stocks. I own a few stocks. I have money in the stock market. It's mostly just through like a robo advisor, Wealthfront, for tax reasons, things like
that. Rich people love Wealthfront. For those of you guys listening, literally every person I know who I consider rich like touts rich Wealthfront.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a way better way to invest in stocks, but I just think for me, it would take a lot of time. Probably, I don't know. It seems very efficient. And so I'd rather probably just try to compete in other areas. The ones that you mentioned, crypto, trading cards, which I think represent like a broader alternative asset investment space, which I think will, I don't know about trading cards. There's really smart people that I trust that know more about it than me that think that trading cards will continue to go up at least for the next 6 months or 12 months or something. The broader space of alternative investments I really believe in. So things like art, digital art, trading cards is representing like a player stock market type of thing, streetwear.
Are you gonna tout CryptoKitties to me?
I'm not comfortable yet, but talk to me in 2 weeks about it. No,
we're like we're like heading back to that to the CryptoKitties era though.
I think we might be the digital art scene. I'm really interested in right now. I'm about to make a big move in digital art, I think. Yeah, it seems like kind of ridiculous at first, but when you like start to think about what art represents and what it is and what it means to hold value and things like that, like why is gold valuable and these different things. I think that there's definitely something there. In terms of cards, one of the big problems with cards right now is that newer cards, there's no guarantee of scarcity, which is of course like a prerequisite to value, and so I'm scared about that. So a lot of the people that I've been talking to that are investing bigger, more buying vintage cards, small sport vintage cards, where the scarcity is guaranteed, they can't reproduce those. But yeah, I think that that market will sort of get disrupted, and you'll have someone come in that guarantees scarcity, presumably on blockchain, and cards will blow up in that way.
So, sell me on digital art as something to invest in, because like I, so you know, my investment portfolio is like I'm certainly it's not like mega wide or anything, but I'm certainly always looking to, you know, get into something new that's exciting that releases that serotonin and that dopamine in a different way, right? So, I mean, I could be sold on digital art if you have a good sales pitch right now.
No, I don't know that my pitch is that good. I think that digital art, tokenized art that's based off of real art is a lot less risky. So, you have a, say you own a, you own a whatever painting, actual physical painting. It could be reproduced. It could be, there's fraud issues in art. When you tokenize it, you sort of, you have a public record of who owns it, of scarcity. And say you were going to buy a valuable piece of art, you probably, to guarantee its future value, you might not even display that, right? Like it might actually be a hassle to even have the piece of physical art. So when you think of it in that way, you remove the physical component. There really is no reason that that should even exist. If you have a digital record of custody and can prove scarcity, then that should be enough. And it just becomes really interesting. And then when you add, there's all these really cool, visual things that people are doing that you can't do. Obviously, like if you have a painting on a canvas, it just sits there. You can look at it, whatever. There's really cool things people are doing with VR, where you can, hold up your phone and the painting changes. I saw a piece of digital art based on Bitcoin's price. It changes based on Bitcoin's price every single day.
Sold.
The volatility and the price changes affect the art, and a new painting is created every single day. It just sold for $101,000. It was a Matt Cain piece. Yeah, it's just really interesting conceptual things you can do that I think are awesome.
All right, I'm sold. I mean, just the idea of something that changes with the Bitcoin price is I'm all in. Also, I think that maybe something that someone who is not very familiar with crypto or anything, that they would hear the word tokenized and not really understand what that means. And like, I guess the way I understand tokenization is that, like, that basically would mean that your piece of art is on the blockchain, and so everyone else on the blockchain or all the other nodes on the blockchain have the ability to verify that that is your work of art, not someone else's work of art, and to to trace the ownership, essentially.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, if you were to think about it in terms of the trading card thing, which, you know, could turn into a player stock market, or it could be like millennial art type of thing, it's just provable scarcity. And so if there's more, you know, if Panini or whatever decides to print more cards of a player, no one really knows that, the value goes down, but everyone is unsure, they don't know what to invest in. On blockchain, it's completely provable. The scarcity is, you know, demonstrated to everybody. And it's just like a very obviously better way to do things to me.
I mean, it certainly is. I'm listening to this conversation. I'm wondering, you might be, of all the people I know, the person who is most likely to be involved in DeFi with all of the yield farming and the ETH tokens. Is that something that you've gotten into, or are you not there yet?
I have indirect exposure to it, but I'm not personally doing any yield farming or anything. I'm aware of what's going on, though.
I really like, I mean, I consider myself to be like, you know, not a boomer or anything, and like relatively up to speed on all this stuff. And like, I don't even for real understand DeFi and how, well, okay, I understand how DeFi works. I guess what I don't understand is like the use of it, like who, like what is my motivation for buying, selling, trading, yield farming on these DeFi platforms?
Yeah, I don't know enough about it. I mean, the motivation is I believe that it's effectively that if you get in earlier than other people, that it has increasing value to you. There's just value to sort of be the first and stay in type of thing. But yeah, what is the underlying value? I don't know. It is similar to the digital art type of thing. Like when it's based off of a physical painting and, you know, you can just prove ownership on blockchain, it's kind of obvious to me. Why would anyone invest in any art? But then when it becomes digital, you know, it's like, well, everyone, you know, you own like a JPEG or something.
Sure.
Is that actually like inherently valuable, even if you can prove, you know, you're the owner of this JPEG, but everyone can share it, they can save it to their computer, whatever. I don't know. It makes you question, I guess, what it means to own anything, or question, the reason for art or different things like this. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is where that conversation of investing and speculation and, you know, why do I own gold? Why do you own Bitcoin? Why do you, you know, and it's just that you get to the very essence of, like, you know, what makes things worth anything? And the answer is just always someone else says it's worth something, so you can exchange money for it, which you can then exchange for goods, for stuff you want, or for survival. Like, it's all a feedback loop of someone else places value on something in relation to something else, which is, it's a fun thought experiment to go down, I suppose.
Yeah, it's exactly right. You're trying to, you know, everyone agrees that the dollar has value because you can give this piece of paper to someone, and then get their time or, whatever it is, a product. And when you really go down the rabbit hole, is there a reason that an animation online that everyone has access to shouldn't hold the same type of intrinsic value that you can exchange for dollars or whatever, you know, if it's representative of, in the same way a piece of paper is representative of someone's future time, why can't a cool piece of art be that? And it's actually like better. Like I'd rather have an awesome piece of art online than a $20 bill or something.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. That one for me is sort of like, well, maybe I would rather have $20. I don't know. That would be, I mean, it's literally something I've never even thought about until this conversation. So maybe I would need to think about that one more, but you evaded part of my question there, where I'm wondering, you know, from someone who certainly, you know, I think you have a good understanding of, like, maybe not what tail risks could impact us, but just the existence of tail risks in general. You know, what are you as a, you know, a casual or semi-serious investor in things? Like, where is your panic meter of feeling like all of these things that are at very high all-time valuations are feeling like a bubble?
I think they're all separate. Like, stocks and crypto sort of move in unison in a lot of ways, but crypto is more similar to gold probably in that it's a hedge against, you know, if things go really poorly, I want to own Bitcoin, I want to own gold or silver. And so, yeah, the stocks, I don't know, I'm not an expert, but it seems like there's not that many ways that stocks continue to go up that much, but many ways that they that the stock market could crash.
Right.
You know, there's very obvious risk from the virus. We don't know that it's gone. I think that recently it's continued to go up. I don't know, but I think that probably for me, it's a situation where I'm not going to have like a huge percentage of my net worth in the stock market. And I do have a much larger percentage in crypto and increasingly more in these different forms of alternative investments.
So are you in terms of crypto, like, are you, do you consider yourself to be, you know, a Bitcoin maximalist or just someone who's interested in the space in general? Like, are you feeling, you know, confident, good about Ethereum? We all had the KuCoin period, right? Where, like, you know, Dentacoin was going 100x overnight. What was the DBC, Deep Brain Chain, was the one that all the DFS guys got into? I think I am personally at a place in my life where I don't have it in me to gamble on altcoins.
Yeah. Oh man, the KuCoin days. It was like a
the glory days.
Oh yeah, it was like a 6-day period where it was. I got KuCoin. I was mainly just in KuCoin, the coin, and got it at, I don't know, maybe $2, and then it went up to like 21 in 3 days or something. It's just absurd. Yeah, those were the days. Currently, I own only Bitcoin and Ethereum. And there's times where I will have a lot of Binance, but those are the only three, I think, even over the past 12 months that I've owned.
Well, I mean, a good measured statement from Jonathan Bales. I have to say, like, 3 years ago, I would have been like, quant stamp is the future. I don't have it in me to give those takes anymore. Also, you know, part of it is crypto used to be this like fascinating world where there was something new happening every day. There were like, it was in the news. We had Jim Cramer on CNBC telling people how to buy Ripple. And, you know, I mean, maybe it's just me that feels this way, but I actually sort of feel like crypto is sort of, at least amongst, like, you know, people who are under the age of, like, let's say 40 or 35, crypto is just kind of just a part of, like, the fabric of things that people understand and talk about and, like, acknowledge that it exists. Whereas, like we're just much less likely to wake up and see a New York Times article about, like, Bitcoin boys the way we would have in 2017, even though Bitcoin has been, you know, above those price levels for, like, all of 2020.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, yeah, I think that's good overall for Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. I think, it's probably increased in price more in line with the value that it's providing and less on speculation, although it's still very speculative, of course. But yeah, I just think, again, the nature of, if you truly understand, to understand Bitcoin is to understand that it's going to increase in price relative to the dollar. Like, the chances that Bitcoin is down in the next 5 years relative to the dollar, I think, are like almost zero.
I love that confidence, Bales. That gets me jazzed up. I'm very glad to hear that. Okay, the people always get triggered when I talk about investing for too long. So we're gonna change tunes here a little bit. If the listeners to the show, we're gonna read one of the five Nassim Taleb books, and they were gonna pick one to start, or they were just gonna read one of them. Which one would you recommend?
I think the one that had the biggest impact on me for sure is Anti-Fragile. I would start, if you're going to read more than one, I would probably just start with Black Swan. I think it's easier read and a prerequisite kind of to Anti-Fragile. But Anti-Fragile is the revolutionary concept to me from Taleb, and that's the one that impacted me the most and really my entire thought process in DFS and business, investing, everything is sometimes you read a book and it changes your life, and that one changed my life.
So I have to say, I've heard many people say these things about his books, and I was always like, there's no way, right? Like I had not read any of his books until this year, until I just, you know, during like real lockdown quarantine, I just had nothing to do but read. And I have to say, it's pretty accurate in terms of like, no one you learned to think from said not only the main theories from behind what Taleb is talking about, but even in the way in which he communicates it, like some of the ideas in Fooled by Randomness and Black Swan, you just truly would have never been presented them in school by your friends, like even by intelligent people, you know, even by, you know, your smartest professor, right? And I would actually say for most people in DFS, I would actually recommend Fooled by Randomness, starting with that one, because I think that's a little bit easier to go from not really thinking about the world that way to like actually understanding like some of the math on like a more practical level. Cause that's really what it is it's books kind of about how math in a way impacts like all of our daily lives.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. I mean, I studied philosophy in college. I loved philosophy. Like I just pretty much exclusively read philosophy.
I didn't know you studied philosophy in college.
Yep. Yeah, that was my major, and philosophy and psychology. But every single elective course that I took was philosophy too. I took every single philosophy class that I possibly could, mainly Eastern philosophy. But my favorite philosopher was Nietzsche, and I just love, you know, I think he's a genius, the father of modern psychology. Really, Freud took all his ideas and the first person to apply evolutionary psychology and the ramifications of Darwinism to how we live and stuff. And I think that Taleb is a modern day Nietzsche. He's just, he's genius, and the way that he thinks about things is just, it's so far beyond what anyone else is doing, in my opinion. So yeah, huge Taleb fan.
So I guess that's sort of interesting. You said that about Nietzsche. I think that, I think maybe in a way, like jokes about Nietzsche in the right, like writers of, you know, like literary fiction from like the 80s and 90s, which is a lot of what I would have been reading in college. Like maybe not jokes, but like everything, a lot of the things I knew about Nietzsche were referential, and I kind of had a very, like, I had a very clear thought of what reading his books would be like before I read them. And I liked his books, but I did not find them that transformational to me. I think some of the philosophy I liked the most when I was in college and doing a lot of reading and, you know, not as hopelessly addicted to DFS and stuff like that, I found Sartre to be the best. I found that to get more like, but that's a little bit less, I guess, about you know, day-to-day life and more about just like, you know, what it means to be alive in general.
Yeah, very theoretical in some ways. Yeah, Nietzsche is similar to Taleb in that it's I just think so practical. It's like these things that you can apply every day. And sort of the entire concept is that, that there are all these smart people and academics, and there's all these different theories about how things should work, and it just doesn't matter. It's what actually works, and those are the people that we should trust, the people taking on risk, the people actually doing the things that matter, and those are the things that we should place our belief in. If you want to know how business works, then study a great entrepreneur. You don't go to business school. If you want to know how football works, then look at someone betting on football, not, listen to Skip Bayless or something.
Not listen to a bunch of worthless touts on the internet.
Well,
That's actually, you know, that's actually really interesting, because I had never even, I until you had just brought that up, I had never even thought about, how that applies to football. And I think that there's like this very classic dichotomy that would come up that I actually think, like, in the case of, like, how the internet gets mad when coaches don't do the right thing and, like, going for two or not going for it on fourth down. No, what Taleb would be on the side of the coaches. He would not be on the side of the nerds on the internet. I'd never thought about that until right now, but that's, like, definitely the case.
I don't know if he would
We gotta ask him. We gotta get the direct line into him and ask him, because this is a place where, like, his, you ask the people with the most experience who've been there where the bullets are flying, like, they're the ones who are gonna know.
Yeah, that's actually a really good hypothetical. I think he's on the side of what works. And so the
Sure.
fact that the coaches have gotten it wrong so frequently in the past, I don't think it's like evidence in their favor that they're very clearly wrong.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess, and there are some experts who are, I guess what Taleb would say is there are some people who, just by the nature of their field being so protected, don't actually have to feel the brunt of their decisions. And coaching is actually a great example of that, where it doesn't matter how bad of an NFL head coach you are, you will get another NFL job. Freddie Kitchens, one of the worst head coaches we've ever seen, still has an NFL coaching job. He is the, I think, the New York Giants tight ends coach or something. But the fact is, he still has a job. He is feeling no personal brunt of, like, his massive failures for the Browns. So I guess that's probably what Taleb's response to that would be, is
Yeah,
that.
I think coaches are generally aware that they're optimizing for like future hireability. So that yeah, they are making decisions with their that it's not it, the, their incentives really aren't aligned a lot of times with doing the right thing mathematically.
Yeah. Okay. Keeping this going here. So this might age poorly, but, like, I am assuming that, across a long enough timeline, COVID-19 is going to become something that, like, we look back and we're like, that was a crazy year, 2 years, whatever. What I think is interesting is, what do you expect to be the societal impacts, long term of this? Working from home becoming maybe, like, actually more normal, and, like, offices just really diminishing. The United States turning more into, like, a mask society, like in Japan, and some of those really, really industrial countries in Europe and Asia, like, they're, like, wearing masks is something that, like, people do, especially people who are immunocompromised, just in general. I also think another thing that I haven't heard this talked about really widely, but just in general, in-home entertainment really replacing live events, like fewer concerts, right? Movies going directly to Amazon Prime instead of coming out in theaters, stuff like that. And I'm kind of wondering some of your thoughts on that.
Yeah, a lot there. I think that in general, probably COVID has sped up the timeline on a lot of things that were going to happen anyway. The biggest one that I've been a believer in is work from home. Not because it's like inherently better for people to work from home. For some people, it is. Like for me, if I go into an office, I can't do anything. I'm completely drained.
Nothing.
I
Yeah.
don't want to interact with people. It's like it's a disaster. I just can't do anything. Other people get energized from going out, being around people. and you know they're better off in an office situation. But so you know, it's a give and take. I don't think one is inherently better than another, but long term, you know, theoretically, people should be, the internet should improve the overall ability for people to be sort of working on the thing that they're supposed to. And so if you're a business and your available pool of talent is everyone in the world, because you can, the people can work online and work from home, then you should be getting A plus people all the time, right? Like Fantasy Labs was online. We had no physical office. The engineers went into an office together, but we could hire anybody. And because of that, we were able to hire like the best person for their job.
Every job. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That doesn't need to be someone, you know, I'm in Philly. It doesn't need to be people who live in Philly, which, you know, there's a couple million people here compared to billions of people worldwide. We should be able to hire the best possible people. So, I think that the ability to work remotely is so much better overall for the economy for that reason. You can hire people that should be doing what they're supposed to be doing. And then the other things, mask usage, I assume, will continue in the future. I don't know. I don't have like a very strong opinion on that. But it seems like a lot of the things that we're doing lately, sort of, we're a little bit behind, some Asian cultures. You know, and I think they've been wearing masks like just regularly when traveling and stuff, and
like forever.
Yeah. And there's a lot of things we're sort of tailing Japan and China and, other Asian countries. So I think that could continue. The entertainment thing, like movies going right to Prime is probably likely, but certain things you can't really replace human interaction. Other people love it, from what I hear. I'm not a big fan, but but like, you know, some people like to be around other humans.
I didn't really know until like the last six months I didn't really know that you were like that much of a recluse. Like, you don't, like in many of your media appearances and stuff, you don't give off the recluse vibes.
I have to gear up. It's all my energy going into these things. I'm not that big into, yeah, pretty shy in general, I guess. But yeah, that, like, you know, like a going to a concert or something, you can't replace that at home. So that part would be tough.
Do you like concerts, or is that just too much for you?
No, I don't like concerts. I go to festivals and stuff sometimes. But usually if I do drugs.
I mean, I don't consider myself like a huge people person or anything like that. Like, I think I like to talk more than I like people, if that makes sense. Like I think I just enjoy talking so much, and like being around other people tend to be it tends to be like a springboard for that. But yeah. I do actually really miss going to concerts. Like that, like of like going to the movies, going out to dinner, you know, like, yeah, I mean, that those things are nice. Like, that's a, you know, that's a nice, you know, kind of break to the monotony of life in general or whatever. But like, concerts is the one thing. Like, there's been like some new music that's come out over the last couple months, and I'm like, oh, you know, I'm just not going to see any of these songs in concert for years, probably. Cause even after, you know, things start to happen again, don't think I'm going to feel super comfortably. You know, I'm not going to feel very like if Lollapalooza happens in 2021, which I've gone every year for the last 3 years, like I don't think I would go in 2021, like without a vaccine, even if it was happening.
Yeah. I've seen that they're doing some festivals, like drive-in things where people are like,
yes,
raving in their cars and stuff. It just seems like, I don't know. It seems like, you know, you're losing like the entire value of the festival, which is like being near the music.
Yeah. Being near the music and being near people, and just like, yeah, it's like, you might as well just watch a YouTube video at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I also, I actually think the mask thing in the States is like not going to happen. Like even like once, you know, we roll the mission accomplished banner out here in the States, I do like masks are going to be done. That's kind of what I think. I think people here just like, for whatever reason, people in the States are just like, they really hate masks.
Yeah. It seems like very dependent on where you live. Like what, I mean, in Philly, I would say even now, over 90% of people on the street have a mask on. Like almost everyone is wearing a mask. People go out and they're doing things. They're going out to eat and stuff, but almost everyone wears a mask. And from what I hear, that's not the case across the country.
Yeah. So I live in St. Louis, and if I go, you know, if I go to the grocery store, if I go run to get a cup of coffee, you know, whatever, take the dogs to the vet, everyone has a mask. I never see people here in the city without a mask, but about 3 weeks ago, I went to a lake house with some buddies and like, you know, I stopped to get gas in the backwoods of Missouri, you know, went into a grocery store out there. And it was like literally like living in an alternate universe. Like these people were under a completely different life experience for mine at this point in time, and it like kind of blew my mind that like we lived an hour apart, but that was the experience that they were having.
I just went home for my birthday dinner with my family. I grew up like about 2 hours outside of Philly in a really rural area, and went back we just went to a restaurant and no one was wearing a mask. It seemed like I felt out of place that I even had a mask on when I walked in. It's just completely different.
Yeah, it is. And it makes you feel like self-conscious of wearing the mask. But at the same point, you're like, this is like the number one place in the world where I'm likely to get germs I don't want because these people don't care at all. So you just got to do it.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Over a 10-year scale, what does Jonathan Bales see as the future of fantasy sports, you know, really as, you know, DraftKings and FanDuel are financially motivated to promote their sports betting products, you know, the sports books are signing deals with ESPN, Fox has Fox Bet. We have, you know, we have Troy Aikman talking about the spread in the middle of broadcasts. Like I, as someone who like, I love fantasy sports more than I love sports betting. Like I enjoy the action regardless, but like I just personally like fantasy sports more than I like sports betting, and I'm kind of wondering what your thoughts on that are.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I like playing games.
Yes,
I like the game theory. I like the element of like trying to outpredict people, and I don't think that'll go away. I think DFS season long fantasy will remain the same or even grow. I don't think that you know, sports betting is going to kill those things because they offer. As sports betting exists now, I do think in the future sports betting is going to change. It's going to eventually become it's sort of peer to peer now, but not really. You're still betting against a sports book. You still, you know, you need to beat people to a line or whatever, but it's not really peer to peer. I think it will be peer to peer. It'll be run on blockchain, eventually, I think a lot of the betting will turn into these hybrid betting and fantasy games where you're, you know, betting, you might be betting against a spread on five games, your five favorite games, and then against other people in a tournament fashion or whatever. I think that will eventually where it goes. And then that probably will eat into DFS and season long fantasy. But as of now, they're separate concepts.
Yeah, I mean, I actually really like, you know, there are some smaller sites that are doing the combination like props and DFS where like you're betting on a bunch of props and then you get awarded points for them. And I kind of like those formats. There are, you know, there are some markets out there where there is peer-to-peer betting, but they're all like, you know, they're all super small. Have you tried to use Augur at all?
Yep. Familiar with Augur, and there's a few different Augur concepts, but yeah, it's still the blockchain peer-to-peer is in its infancy right now.
Yeah, if people don't know about Augur, this is like such a niche recommendation, but if you search on the iTunes store for Augur and the Coin Talk show, there just is a very funny and illuminating episode of what people who are like good at technology, own Bitcoin, have transacted in Bitcoin and Ethereum, like their experience of trying to set up an Augur node and place bets on Augur. It's just it's one of my favorite podcasts ever. I would recommend it. Okay. Something this has been the by far for me the worst part of the coronavirus, which means that I am literally like top 5% privilege. But like my workout routine, my fitness stuff, it's been a wreck, dude. Like I have very low motivation. I hate running outside. So I'm wondering, as someone who is mega jacked, what has your fitness routine been like? Like, did you, I guess maybe if you are as much of a hermit as you're saying, maybe you had a home gym set up before.
Well, why has yours gotten worse? Did you go to a gym that closed or whatever?
Yeah. I mean, I had, so here in St. Louis, I had a gym, I mean, a 60-second drive from my house, basically, like right around the corner. And pretty much every day when I would get done working, I would go at like 4 o'clock, I would do cardio first, and then I would do weights, you know, alternating depending on the day of what it was. And I was, you know, in March when everything shut down, I was like hitting like personal bests and running miles and like, you know, like the most weight I'd ever lifted and everything. And, you know, and then to go from that to having, you know, like none of those same resources available was just, was a crusher for me.
Yeah. I have a gym in my apartment building that has been open now. I didn't go to it for a while, but I have like, I forget what they're called, power block, I think, like adjustable dumbbells in my my office here. So yeah, I've always used those and done a lot of body weight stuff, have like a pull-up bar and stuff. So my workout stuff didn't really change that much, I guess. I think that if you're like motivated to work out, you just like find a way to work out type of thing.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I think I have to think about it more to articulate. Like I just have a much more difficult time, like you know, just kind of like developing those habits of like, okay, you know, it's 4 o'clock. Like I need to go and lift weights for 30 minutes now. Like it's just for a lot of like, I mean, probably just because I get very easily distracted and everything I like is at my house. I have my dogs, you know, I have my PlayStation. My girlfriend's always here. Like, you know, there's just always something that's a little bit more entertaining to do than to go lift weights, which is,
something more entertaining than lifting weights. It's awful.
Right. Exactly. And
I don't understand the people that like to work out. It fucking sucks. I hate it. I don't know if people think I work out all the time. Like I go through spurts where I don't work out for weeks or months. It's awful. I hate it.
I think you work out all the time. Like I can't see you right now because we don't have our Zoom call on. Like if you were like, oh yeah, dude, I'm knocking out some curls right now, like I wouldn't be that surprised.
Yeah. I think that when I work out, I almost always lift weights. I think it's probably the most efficient thing to do long term. And I walk around the city a lot. I think that's like, you know, not like a great workout, but you know, if you walk a few miles a day, I think it's good for mental health as well and stuff. But otherwise, yeah, I really have to force myself to work out. It's not like I'm just working out every day. It sucks.
Yeah, I think, like we have weights here. I have a jump rope. Like it's not like, my excuses for working out at home are not like, oh, I don't have the space or, you know, I live in a house. So it's not like I'm in an apartment where I'd be bothering the neighbors. Like it literally does just come down to like, I've been too lazy to reform the habits without the gym. Like that's really what it comes down to.
Yeah.
Not great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, I just saw you tweet this today. What's going on with your Substack? I know that I had seen in the past that you'd posted some things on it. Are you planning on posting more often on this Lucky Maverick Substack?
So this is kind of funny. I, I didn't really know. I just I created like a one. I uploaded a few articles that I had already written on my personal site, my blog, and just started this Substack, which was like whenever I want to post stuff, I'm gonna post stuff on through the Substack and send it out to people. I thought it was free. I didn't know that people could pay me, and now
You
like.
didn't know that you this was a cash cow?
I made like I think over $5,000 already, and I didn't even know that I could get paid.
How rich? How rich, John?
I have no idea what's going on, so now I'm gonna have to publish it because people are paying me. I don't know if I'm gonna send the money back. Like, I don't know what's going on. Dude, this was not.
Dude, this is incredible.
No one knows this. I haven't told anyone, so it's gonna come out on this podcast. I had no idea. Like I keep getting paid for this fucking newsletter that I was like, oh, maybe I'll do this if I want to. So now I'm doing the newsletter because I'm either going to send the money back or I'm going to do the newsletter. So
One of the two things. I mean, you could probably get away with doing once a week, 2,000 to 4,000 words, and I bet that you would feel fine providing that service and people would feel fine paying for it.
I think so. I mean, my intent was to do it anyway, but now, you know, I'm
Now you feel
obligated.
like you have to. Now it's work.
It's
Yeah.
very different.
Yeah, that is very different. That's so funny. 'Cause I had remembered when you posted the 40 counterintuitive business tips. But I just went to your Twitter when I went to go send you the Zoom link, and I was like, oh, I had no idea this was something you were like trying to like promote and like take a little bit more seriously. So that's very funny.
Yeah, I wasn't.
Oh, that's so good. All right, let's end with this. How are we betting on the 2020 elections? I refuse to bet. I won't do it because I don't want to I don't want to be rooting against myself or anything like that. But I mean, do you have a follow-up to the Trump 50-1 winner?
Yeah, it was 150-1, and
Oh, I'm always shortchanging you, dude. I'm always trying to not give you enough credit.
no, I knew nothing about politics then to be betting on it. I know nothing now. My guess, based on everything that I've seen, is that Biden is probably a good bet. There's been a few smart people that probably know better than me that I know that have bet on Biden, and I think that the logic behind betting on Trump before. When I was doing it, was mostly like, you know, payoffs. It was really a Taleb-esque anti-fragility type of thing, and that no longer exists. I don't know that there's like good reason to think that the same concepts apply that people would be shortchanging him. Maybe, but I just don't know. So I don't have any great insights on it. I have zero bets on the election. I don't know that I will, but if I had to guess, I would. If I had to bet, I would bet on Biden right now.
I think the most interesting part of the actual like vote, like the election part, like not, the political outcomes or like what's going to happen to the country and everything, but from like a math outcomes probability perspective is I wonder what, basically a huge upset by the people, by the polling, right? Polling basically just had 2016 as like, a no contest. Like you could have gotten Trump the day of the election at like 12-1 even. And I'm wondering if those results, that such an underwhelm or such an overwhelming upset, I'm wondering if that changed the way that polling happened or changed the way that, the people who are who doing all these election probability models, I'm wondering how much that caused them to change or alter their models, or if they even should, right? If it was just such an outlier that changing the models would actually ruin their ability to be predictive.
Well, they have to change the models because, like, we have the outcome. They were wrong. Like,
Yes.
you don't need more than a sample size of one to know that everything was wrong. Every model was basically wrong. There were some that introduced more uncertainty, like inherent to the model. Like Nate Silver was saying Trump had a larger chance to win than other people, but the reality was Trump's chances of winning were 100%, right? Like he was gonna win because that like he crushed. All those people went and voted for him. It was the day of the election. It was 100%, and they were just trying to guess what it was. So the models were wrong. There's no doubt about it. They have to be changed. How much they have been changed and things like that, I don't know. And how much people, in general, people do not factor enough uncertainty into their predictions across like every area. And I assume that that's the same in politics. But yeah, everything seems in Biden's favor right now. But how much they've introduced uncertainty into their models, I have no idea.
My sense is not enough from just like a very light reading of, all of the modeling and all of the polls. Something I just get like random, like, random election forecaster polling people, arguing about things. They just find their way into my lists or into my timelines every once in a while. And my sense is that many of them are not making enough changes, that they do sort of feel 2016 was just, such an all-time outlier that they don't want to change their models that much because they feel that the models are strong and they don't want to junk all of that
Yeah,
progress.
that just seems so weird to me. It's not like a football game where if the Chiefs play the Ravens 1,000 times, it's not like the Chiefs are going to win 1,000 times. It's going to be, 450, whatever it is.
Sure.
The election is not like that to me. Like the day of the election, there's someone's like, maybe someone gets sick, they don't go vote. It's not going to change that much. Like whoever's going to win is going to win pretty much. Like that's just the way that it is the day that the election happens. So whoever is the underdog, or what, whatever the models say, theoretically with perfect knowledge, it should be like 100% or like near 100%. And if it's not, which it shouldn't be for like our ability to make predictions, but in reality, that's what it is. It's not like a Chiefs Ravens situation where there's so much uncertainty in the actual process of playing the game. The election is what it is, and we're just trying to like get closer and closer to reality. And my guess is they're just really bad at figuring out reality of the elections.
Yeah, I mean, that's like what you just said gets at the heart of, if I was going to tell people one thing from Taleb's books, it would be that just because something happens in your real life, like it actually happened, you saw it happen, it affects your day-to-day life, it still doesn't mean that that was the most likely outcome, right? That like if something is 70-30, the 30% thing can happen, and that doesn't mean that the 70% probability was wrong. It just means that the less it just means that the less predicted thing like actually happened, and people just like in general literally just cannot wrap their heads around it. Like they just do not understand the concept.
Yeah, and the thing is that as you go down in probability of something happening, the payoffs go up exponentially. So you go down to 5%, and instead of getting, the market value should be 20 to 1, you get 100 to 1. And then you go to 1%, and instead of getting 100 to 1, you get like 20,000 to 1 or whatever. So you like take on, if you're willing to lose more frequently, as long as the payoffs are right, you can make more and more and more and more. And you just need to stay in the game and wait, and you'll eventually get paid off if you're on the right side of things.
Beautiful. A great way to end the show. Bales, give people your Lucky Maverick Substack sales pitch.
Oh God, I don't even know what to.
You
You
don't
are
have to. You can just tell them about Labs.
I think I bought, let me check. I think I bought luckymaverick.com. You can just go there. Yeah, it redirects to it,
There we go. He bought luckymaverick.com. He's ready to fill your inbox with many, many great and beautiful insights.
that is correct.
Yeah. All right, Bales, thanks for joining us. Everyone, thanks for listening. We'll be back soon.